By 2020, the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd had lived in the cold case files for 36 years. Most people in Garden Grove barely remembered her name. The neighbors who had whispered about it in 1984 had moved away or passed on. The crime scene had been repainted, re-rented, and folded back into the rhythm of the city. But the box with her case number was still there, sealed, patient, and waiting. Detective Karen Holt didn't know Shannon personally. She was only a child when Shannon died. But when she took over the city's newly revived cold case unit, Shannon's file kept pulling her back. It wasn't just the crime itself. It was the evidence. So many cold cases from the 1980s had been destroyed, contaminated, or lost. Shannon's had survived. Inside the envelopes were fingernail scrapings, hair fibers, and clothing swatches, all still sealed from 1984. Back then, they were useless. Now they could speak, if the right person was willing to listen. The first time Holt held the envelope containing the fingernail scrapings, she knew what it meant. "This," she told me, "is probably the last conversation Shannon will ever have with the world. And it's my job to make sure someone's listening." In early 2021, the evidence went to the Orange County Crime Lab. The technicians handled it like it was made of glass. DNA testing in cold cases is a high-wire act. Too aggressive, and you destroy the sample. Too cautious, and you get nothing. Weeks passed, then months. On a gray Tuesday morning, the match appeared. It wasn't a suspect already in custody. It wasn't a man on the run. It was someone living an ordinary life, whose DNA had been collected in a separate, unrelated case years after Shannon's death. When Holt saw the name on the screen, she didn't shout. She didn't smile. She just sat back in her chair and stared at it. This was the moment every cold case detective dreams of, and fears. Because a DNA match is only the beginning. It doesn't explain motive. It doesn't tell you where the suspect was that night. And it doesn't prepare you for what happens when you knock on their door. For 37 years, the killer had been a shadow. Now he had a name. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 6: A Detective Returns. When Detective Karen Holt stepped into the Garden Grove Police Department's evidence room in early 2021, she wasn't looking for Shannon Rose Lloyd's file. She was there to get acquainted with the cold case backlog she had just inherited, more than 200 boxes, some dating back to the 1960s. The room smelled faintly of dust and cardboard. Metal shelves stretched from floor to ceiling, each row labeled in black stenciled numbers. Holt moved slowly, scanning the spines of the case boxes. Some were neatly stacked, others sagging under decades of weight. The older boxes were covered in scrawled handwriting from detectives who had long since retired or passed away. Shannon's case caught her eye for one reason. It was complete. So many older files had gaps, missing evidence logs, photographs that had faded beyond recognition, envelopes split open by time. But here, every item was intact. The crime scene photos were still sharp. The evidence envelopes were still sealed, their labels legible. Even the autopsy report was crisp, as if it had been printed yesterday. Holt carried the box to a small table in the corner and began flipping through the contents. The first layer was photographs. Shannon's apartment, the doorway, the coffee table pushed askew, the tipped-over lamp. Holt lingered on the image of Shannon herself, taken from the crime scene before the coroner arrived. In her years of working homicide, Holt had learned to keep a mental distance when looking at victims, but this one stayed with her. The position of Shannon's body, almost peaceful, as if she had been caught mid-rest, clashed violently with the reality written in the autopsy report. Beneath the photos were the interview transcripts. They painted a picture Holt knew well. Too many witnesses with too few details, suspects with shaky alibis, and a set of detectives doing their best with limited tools. She could see the points where the investigation had run out of road. And then she found the envelopes. Two of them, each sealed with brittle masking tape and marked in a blocky 1980s hand. Fingernail scrapings, Lloyd S.R. Fibers, Lloyd S.R. Holt picked them up carefully. In 37 years, they had never been opened since the original forensic tech sealed them. In 1984, there had been no way to extract DNA from material this small without destroying it entirely. Now, with modern testing, even a few skin cells could tell a story. She set the envelopes aside and went back to the file. The notes from 2011 caught her attention, a cold case audit marking the evidence as viable for future testing. Yet somehow no one had followed through. I asked Holt later why she thought it had been overlooked. She shrugged. Sometimes these cases are like orphan children. Everyone means to help them, but they keep getting passed over because someone else always seems more urgent. That wasn't going to happen on her watch. Holt had joined the force in the late 90s, just as DNA was becoming a standard investigative tool. She'd seen firsthand how a cold case could be resurrected with a single match. She also knew the emotional toll of telling a family there was finally news after decades of silence. Her first step was to get approval to test the evidence. In most departments, this isn't as simple as sending it to the lab. The request goes up the chain of command, weighed against budget, backlog, and the perceived solvability of the case. In 2021, Garden Grove's backlog was heavy, but the pandemic had slowed new case flow enough to make room for old ones. Holt prepared a formal memo outlining the case history, the preserved evidence, and the potential for a DNA hit in state or national databases. She included copies of the original evidence logs and photographs of the sealed envelopes to prove their condition. She ended the memo with a single line. "This is the last opportunity we may have to identify Shannon Lloyd's killer." It worked. Approval came within 2 weeks. The evidence was couriered to the Orange County Crime Lab in a locked container, signed for at each handoff. Holt went with it, not because she had to, but because she wanted to be there when it arrived. "It felt like I was delivering something priceless," she told me. And in a way, I was. At the lab, a forensic analyst named Paul Rivera took custody of the evidence. Rivera had been working in forensics for nearly 2 decades. He understood the stakes of testing samples this old. "The trick," he said, "is to balance the risk. You can't go at it like you would a fresh sample. You have to coax the DNA out." Rivera explained the process to Holt step by step. "Carefully open the original envelope to avoid contamination. Transfer the material to a sterile workspace. Use a low copy number DNA extraction technique to maximize recovery. Amplify the sample through PCR, polymerase chain reaction, without degrading what's left." It could take weeks before they knew if they even had a viable profile. Holt returned to the station knowing she was now in a waiting game, one she couldn't control. In the meantime, she began digging into the original suspect list, cross-referencing it with modern databases. She pulled criminal records, employment histories, and address changes. Some of the original suspects were dead. Others were still living in California. None, as far as she could tell, had ever been charged with anything similar. When the call from Rivera finally came, it was early morning. Holt was in her office, working through another cold case file, when her phone rang. "We got a profile," Rivera said. His tone was calm, but Holt could hear the undercurrent of excitement. "And we got a hit. It wasn't a partial match. It was a full, direct hit in the combined DNA index system, CODIS. The name attached to it was one Holt didn't recognize, someone who had never been on the original suspect list." When she typed the name into her computer, the first thing she found was an address, not far from Garden Grove. The ghost she'd been hunting for 37 years had just stepped into the light. Chapter 7, The DNA Breakthrough. The thing about a DNA match is that it's both a finish line and a starting gun. When the lab told Detective Karen Holt they had a name, it wasn't a solved case. It was an open door to an entirely new investigation. The name on the report was Stephen Richard Hensley, born in 1958, lived most of his life in Southern California. Arrested in 2019 for a felony DUI, during which his DNA was collected and entered into CODIS. That entry, sitting quietly in the database for 2 years, was now the reason his life was about to change. Holt stared at the name on her screen for a long time before she clicked further. There was no mention of Shannon in his history. No violent convictions. In fact, his record was sparse. A few minor offenses in the 80s and 90s, mostly related to alcohol. He'd worked construction, then maintenance. Nothing in the file screamed killer. And yet, his DNA matched the profile pulled from the fingernail scrapings taken from Shannon's body in 1984. I asked Holt what that moment felt like. She leaned back in her chair, thinking, "It's electric but dangerous. You want to run into the street and yell, 'We got him.' But you can't. You have to slow down. You have to verify. DNA doesn't lie, but people can get the wrong idea if you don't build the rest of the case carefully." The first step was to confirm the match through an independent lab. Rivera, the forensic analyst, split the remaining sample and sent it to a private lab for verification. While they waited, Holt began the kind of deep dive that only modern tools allow. She pulled every address Hensley had ever lived at and mapped them out. In 1984, he'd been living less than 4 miles from Shannon's apartment. She found his employment records. At the time of Shannon's murder, he'd been working odd jobs and living alone. She checked marriage and divorce records, noting that he'd married in 1986 and divorced in 1992. There was no direct link to Shannon in any public record, but that didn't mean there wasn't one. Holt began looking at his social circles in the early 80s. Did he know anyone in Shannon's building? Had he ever been to the clothing store where she worked? Did he frequent the bars and restaurants near her home? Holt also pulled the original witness statements from 1984. One in particular stood out: the man who claimed to see a silhouette near Shannon's window. The description was vague, but the height estimate and build could fit Hensley. It was the kind of detail that wouldn't hold up in court alone, but in the context of a DNA match, it carried new weight. The independent lab came back with the same result. The DNA from the fingernail scrapings matched Stephen Richard Hensley with a probability so high it might as well have been certain. With the match confirmed, Holt began working with the Orange County District Attorney's Office to plan the next steps. They needed to approach Hensley without tipping him off. If he suspected he was being investigated for murder, he could flee, destroy evidence, or worse. They started with surveillance. Plainclothes officers parked near his current home, a modest one-story house in a quiet neighborhood. They watched his routines: morning coffee runs, weekly trips to the grocery store, evenings on the porch smoking cigarettes. He seemed unremarkable, the kind of neighbor you nod to but never really know. One officer told me he was friendly enough, waved at people, chatted with the mailman. You'd never look at him and think he was capable of killing someone. Holt's challenge was to connect the dots between this mild-mannered man in 2021 and the violent act committed in 1984. The DNA was the bridge, but she still needed motive, opportunity, and a narrative a jury could follow. She dug into his background further, speaking with people who had known him in the 80s. Some remembered him as quiet, others as a drinker. One woman recalled a party where he'd made inappropriate comments to several women, but nothing that would have led her to suspect murder. Still, it was a piece of character evidence that began to fill in the edges. The DA's office decided they had enough to move forward with an arrest warrant, but they wanted to do it in a way that minimized risk. Hensley wasn't known to own firearms, but no one wanted to take chances. The plan was to arrest him in a public place where he'd be less likely to resist. Holt coordinated with a local patrol unit. They'd wait until he left home for one of his coffee runs, then intercept him in the parking lot. She would be there in person, not because it was necessary, but because after 37 years, she wanted to look him in the eye when he heard Shannon's name. The morning of the arrest was overcast. Hensley came out of his house wearing jeans and a faded baseball cap. He got into his pickup truck and drove to a strip mall cafe. He parked, got out, and started walking toward the entrance. That's when two officers approached, identified themselves, and told him he was under arrest for the murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd. According to Holt, he froze. No denial, no anger. Just a long, blank stare. Then quietly, "Who?" It was either an act, or he'd buried Shannon's name so deep in his memory that hearing it now was like opening a locked door. Either way, the ghost they'd been chasing for nearly 4 decades was no longer a shadow. He was standing in the daylight, surrounded by police, with his past finally catching up to him. Chapter 8, The Arrest. The moment Stephen Richard Hensley was handcuffed in the parking lot, the 37-year shadow over Shannon Rose Lloyd's case shifted into something tangible. For decades, the idea of the killer had been abstract, a faceless presence in old files and fading memories. Now that presence had a height, a weight, a face, and a heartbeat. Detective Karen Holt was there, watching from a short distance. She'd insisted on being part of the arrest, not for the thrill, but for the accountability. This was her case now, and she wanted to see the man who had left Shannon lifeless on her living room floor. The officers moved quickly. One secured Hensley's wrists behind his back, another took his wallet and keys. He didn't fight. He didn't ask why they were arresting him until they guided him toward the patrol car. "Murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd," the officer repeated, loud enough for Holt to hear. Hensley's head turned slightly, just enough to catch Holt's gaze. She said nothing. In her experience, the first words exchanged between detective and suspect could set the tone for everything that followed. She wanted his first conversation to be inside the interrogation room, where every word could be recorded and every reaction preserved. Once Hensley was in the back seat, Holt followed the patrol car to the Garden Grove Police Department. The route was familiar. She'd driven it countless times with other suspects. But this time, every streetlight felt like a checkpoint in a race that had taken nearly 4 decades to run. Inside the station, Hensley was processed like any other arrestee. His fingerprints were taken, his mugshot captured in a series of clicks. He was allowed to use the restroom, then placed in Interview Room 3, a small, windowless space with cinderblock walls painted a neutral gray. The table was metal, the chairs heavy and plain. A video camera in the corner recorded silently. Before entering, Holt and her partner, Detective Luis Moreno, reviewed the strategy. Moreno would start with small talk, ease into the conversation, then let Holt take the lead when it came to the crime. The goal was to keep Hensley talking, not to push him into immediate silence with aggression. When they walked in, Hensley was sitting still, hands flat on the table. He looked older than his 63 years, his skin weathered, his eyes guarded but not hostile. He wore a plain t-shirt and jeans, the same clothes from his coffee run. Moreno started casually. "Stephen, thanks for talking with us. We know it's been a long time since 1984. Hensley raised his eyebrows but said nothing. "You were living in Garden Grove back then?" Moreno asked. "Yeah," Hensley replied, his voice low. "Couple miles from here." Holt leaned forward. "Do you remember Shannon Rose Lloyd?" There was a pause. Not long, but long enough to notice. "No," he said finally. "Should I?" Holt slid a photo of Shannon across the table. Not the crime scene photo, a smiling picture from her family. "She was killed in her apartment in May of 84. We have reason to believe you were there that night." Hensley glanced at the photo, then looked away. "I don't know her." Moreno kept his tone even. "Stephen, we have your DNA from her fingernail scrapings. That means she scratched you during the struggle. There's no mistake about this." Hensley's jaw tightened. "That's impossible. I never met her." Holt let the silence stretch. In interrogation, silence can be more powerful than any question. She watched his hands. They twitched once, then flattened again. "People forget things after 37 years, she said finally. "But DNA doesn't forget. It doesn't get old. It doesn't change. And it's telling us you were the last person to see her alive." For the next hour, Hensley alternated between denial and vague claims that maybe we crossed paths somewhere. He offered no explanation for how his DNA ended up under Shannon's nails. He didn't ask for a lawyer immediately, but he also didn't give a confession. Holt had expected this. In her experience, most suspects in decades-old cases didn't break in the first interview. The shock of the arrest, the unfamiliarity of being back in police custody, it made them cautious. The goal today wasn't a confession. It was to gauge his reactions, to note his tells, and to lock him into statements that could later be challenged with evidence. When Hensley finally asked for an attorney, the interview ended. Holt stood, collected the file from the table, and left the room without another word. In the hallway, Moreno exhaled. "He's not going to admit it." "Not today," Holt said. "But he doesn't need to. We have the science. Now we build the rest." Building the rest meant retracing Hensley's life from 1984 onward. Detectives searched his old residences, talked to former landlords, and tracked down people he'd known in the early 80s. Some recalled him as quiet, others as off. One woman described him as the kind of guy who stood too close when he talked to you. They also dug into his work history, looking for connections to Shannon's neighborhood. A faded time card from 1984 showed he'd been doing maintenance work for a company that serviced several apartment complexes, one of them less than 2 blocks from Shannon's building. Meanwhile, the DA's office began preparing the case for court. They knew the defense would attack the age of the evidence, the possibility of contamination, and the reliability of DNA from decades-old samples. Every step of the chain of custody from 1984 onward had to be airtight. For Holt, the arrest was both a victory and a warning. In cold cases, arresting the suspect is not the end. It's often the point where the real fight begins. And if Shannon's family was finally going to see justice, they couldn't afford a single misstep. Hensley was booked into the Orange County Jail on a charge of murder. bail was denied. He was placed in a standard holding cell, surrounded by men half his age. In the eyes of the law, he was now an accused killer. In the eyes of Shannon's family, he was the man they had been waiting to face for 37 years. Chapter 9. Confronting the Past. The morning after Stephen Richard Hensley's arrest, the phones in the Garden Grove Police Department started ringing before the sun was up. By 9 a.m., every major news outlet in Southern California had the story. Arrest made in 1984 murder of Shannon Rose Lloyd, DNA breakthrough after 37 years. For most people reading those headlines, Shannon's name was just another in a long list of crime victims. But for her family, it was a moment they'd been imagining and dreading for nearly four decades. Detective Karen Holt insisted on telling them in person. She called Shannon's younger brother, Mark, now in his late 50s, and asked if the family could meet her at their mother's house. Patricia Lloyd was 81 years old, still living in the same modest home she had when Shannon died. She moved slower now, her hair completely white, but her mind was sharp. When Holt arrived, Patricia was sitting at the kitchen table with a mug of tea in front of her. The table was the same one from 1984, worn smooth in the middle from decades of use. Mark sat beside her, his hands clasped tightly. Holt began gently. "Patricia, Mark, we've made an arrest in Shannon's case. His name is Stephen Richard Hensley. We have his DNA from Shannon's fingernail scrapings. He was living in the area in 1984. Patricia closed her eyes for a long moment. "I prayed for this," she said finally. "I prayed I'd be alive to hear it." Mark's reaction was quieter. "Do you know why he did it?" "Not yet," Holt replied. "But we're going to find out." Patricia reached across the table and took Holt's hand. "Promise me you won't let him talk his way out of this. Promise me he won't get away again." Holt promised. News crews set up outside the police department that afternoon. They wanted footage of the detectives, shots of the building, any scrap of information they could turn into a soundbite. By evening, the case was leading broadcasts in Los Angeles, Orange County, and even San Diego. The public reaction was immediate and intense. Social media lit up with comments from people who had lived in Garden Grove in the 80s. Some remembered Shannon personally, a neighbor, a classmate, a co-worker. Others admitted they'd nearly forgotten about her until the headline jolted the memory back. But not all the reactions were supportive. Some questioned how it could have taken 37 years. Others speculated about whether the right man had been arrested. A few even accused the police of using the case for good PR in the middle of other controversies. Holt ignored the noise. She knew public opinion would swing back and forth until the trial, and possibly even after. What mattered now was building the case. "I reached out to several of Shannon's old friends for interviews. Many declined, saying the arrest had reopened wounds they weren't ready to talk about. But one woman, Lisa Gutierrez, agreed. She'd been Shannon's co-worker at the clothing store in 1984. When I saw his face on the news, I didn't recognize him," Lisa told me. "But I kept thinking, maybe he came into the store once. Maybe Shannon helped him pick out a shirt. That's how close this all feels. Like he could have been right in front of us, and we didn't know." Meanwhile, Holt's team began tracking Hensley's movements in the weeks before his arrest. They wanted to know if he'd heard about advances in DNA testing, or if he'd been acting nervous. Surveillance reports showed no signs of panic. He'd been living quietly, as if confident his past would stay buried. One of the most poignant moments came a few days later, when Patricia visited Shannon's grave for the first time since the arrest. A local reporter captured a photo from a respectful distance. Patricia standing at the headstone, one hand resting on it, the other holding a small bouquet of daisies. The headline the next day read, "Mother stands where justice may finally arrive." That image became the emotional anchor of the case in the media. It wasn't about the suspect anymore. It was about the family, about the cost of waiting 37 years for an answer. Behind the scenes, Holt knew the hardest part was still ahead. DNA was powerful, but it wasn't enough on its own. The prosecution needed to show the jury how Hensley could have been in Shannon's apartment without forced entry, why she would have let him in, and what motive he might have had. That meant confronting the past head-on, digging into Shannon's life, her social circle, and every possible intersection with Hensley's. Some of those answers would come from documents and records. Others would come from people who had been silent for decades. Holt braced herself for what those conversations might reveal. The past had finally stepped into the light. Now it was time to see if it would speak. Chapter 10, Trial and Verdict. The trial of Stephen Richard Hensley began on a cool Monday morning in the Orange County Superior Court. Outside, the courthouse steps were crowded with reporters, photographers, and curious onlookers. It had been 37 years since Shannon Rose Lloyd's murder, but now, her name was on every news banner in Southern California. Detective Karen Holt arrived early, walking past the cameras without stopping. She'd been through dozens of trials, but this one carried a weight unlike any other. It wasn't just about securing a conviction. It was about proving that time hadn't eroded the truth. Inside the courtroom, the atmosphere was tense but orderly. The prosecution table was stacked with thick binders and manila folders, each one containing pieces of a puzzle that had taken decades to complete. Across the aisle, the defense team sat with Hensley, who wore a dark suit and tie. His hair was neatly combed, his face calm. If you didn't know the charges, you might think he was there for a business dispute. Judge Ellen Vargas, a seasoned jurist known for her no-nonsense demeanor, took the bench promptly at 9 a.m. The jury, 12 men and women, ranging in age from their late 20s to their 60s, filed in quietly. They knew this was no ordinary case. The prosecution opened with a timeline that stretched from May 21, 1984, to the present. Deputy District Attorney Michael Reyes spoke plainly, his voice steady. For 37 years, this case waited for science to catch up. And when it did, the evidence pointed to one man, the defendant Stephen Richard Hensley. His DNA was found under Shannon Lloyd's fingernails. That means, in her final moments, she fought him. And she left behind the truth of who killed her. He moved quickly through the history. The discovery of the body, the lack of forced entry, the preservation of the fingernail scrapings. He explained the evolution of DNA testing, showing the jury photographs of the sealed envelopes and describing the chain of custody in meticulous detail. Every step was documented. Every hand that touched the evidence accounted for. When the defense took the floor, attorney James Corcoran went on the offensive. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not a case about murder. This is a case about contamination, about unreliable evidence from almost four decades ago. The police had no idea what they were doing with DNA in 1984, because DNA testing didn't even exist. Now they want you to believe that these old, degraded samples can tell you what happened that night. They can't. And they certainly can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that my client is guilty. From the start, it was clear the defense would attack the science and the time gap, hoping to plant seeds of doubt about the reliability of the evidence. The prosecution's witnesses included the original crime scene technicians, now gray-haired and retired, who testified about how the evidence was collected and stored. They admitted that in 1984, they didn't anticipate DNA testing, but emphasized that they had followed the best evidence handling procedures of the time. Then came the forensic experts. Paul Rivera, the analyst who tested the fingernail scrapings in 2021, explained the process in detail. Using charts and diagrams, he showed how even small amounts of DNA could be amplified without altering its integrity. He also testified that the probability of the DNA belonging to someone other than Hensley was less than one in several trillion. The defense cross-examined aggressively. They asked about the possibility of transfer DNA, contamination in storage, and lab error. Rivera remained composed, acknowledging that contamination is always a theoretical risk, but stressing that in this case, the controls showed none. The most emotional testimony came from Patricia Lloyd. Sitting in the witness box, her voice trembled as she described getting the call in 1984 and the decades of waiting. She didn't look at Hensley while she spoke, but her words hung heavy in the courtroom. "I prayed for this day," she said. "I prayed that someone would have to answer for what they did to my daughter. I don't know why he killed her, but I know he did." When it was time for the defense to present their case, they called only a handful of witnesses. One was a forensic consultant who criticized the handling of evidence in the 80s. Another was a former co-worker of Hensley's, who testified that he had never seen him act violently. The defense did not put Hensley on the stand. Closing arguments brought the trial into sharp focus. Reyes addressed the jury directly. "This case isn't about what the police didn't know in 1984. It's about what we do know now. Shannon fought for her life, and in doing so, she told us exactly who killed her. Don't let 37 years erase her voice," Corcoran countered. The state wants you to ignore the gaps, the uncertainties, the fact that memories fade and evidence degrades. This case is built on sand, and you cannot send a man to prison for life on sand. The jury deliberated for 2 days. Those hours stretched painfully for everyone involved. Holt stayed at her desk, working on other files, but her mind kept drifting back to the jury room. On the afternoon of the second day, the bailiff's voice came over the intercom. "We have a verdict." The courtroom filled quickly. Patricia sat in the front row, Mark beside her. Holt stood near the back, close enough to see, but far enough to stay out of the family's moment. The jury filed in. The foreperson handed the verdict form to the bailiff, who passed it to Judge Vargas. She read it silently, then looked up. "We, the jury, find the defendant, Stephen Richard Hensley, guilty of murder in the first degree." A gasp escaped from Patricia. She covered her mouth, tears streaming down her face. Hensley showed no reaction, his gaze fixed on the table in front of him. Holt exhaled slowly. 37 years of waiting, of false starts and dead ends, had led to this moment. The judge thanked the jury for their service and scheduled sentencing for the following month. As the courtroom emptied, Patricia approached Holt. She didn't say anything. She just hugged her, holding on for a long time. For the first time since 1984, the Lloyd family had an answer. And soon, they would have a measure of justice.